Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy. How's your week been?
My week's been good. My week's been very musical, as I believe yours has.
We went to see some shows, not together.
No, which was a shame. Yes, I went to see the Who and Squeeze and Robert Plant with Saving Grace.
Wow.
And you went to see
10cc.
And something special happened, didn't
it? Well, it was pretty amazing, actually, because it's basically 10cc now. It's obviously Graham Gorman, Rick, the guitar player, Fenn, yeah. who we met because he lives down in Brisbane. And when we played in
That's
Brisbane,
right.
He came to the Sourceful show, didn't he? Rick Fenn on guitar, who actually is part of 10cc solidly now because he's been in the band. I mean, he's not part of that original four, obviously, but he's been in the band since the 70s, since Kevin and Lowell left. And the drummer, whose name escapes me, who's also played drums with them forever and ever, but it's basically Graham Gorman's band, on comes Kevin. Now, Kevin, first of all, doesn't come on. I gave it away, really, because there's a beautiful film that he's obviously directed of him singing a particular song. The band played to that. So you think he's not there, he's there in spirit. And then on he walks. And honestly, he's more godlike than godly. Because he is...
I see what you did there.
Because, I mean, he was brilliant. And he was so good. He sang Cry. He sang this wonderful song that is on Sheep Music, their second album from, I think, 74. And it's called, I believe, the name escapes me, The Wild Men. It's imagining in 1974 that all the rock and rollers were now old guys playing their sort of rusty strings out on some western plain, you know, remembering their past. Of course, that's exactly where they are now, pretty much, you know. They're all old guys. So the poignancy of that song now is... Do you know it at all, Guy?
I can't say that I do. I would have had a listen if I'd been pre-briefed.
I need to find out exactly what it was called. I think it's called The Wild Men. And he did Cry, and it was wonderful, and everyone was crying. And of course, what you realise about 10cc, what shocked me and what made me want to go back to the beginning of and start again as a songwriter was the utter complexity of the arrangements.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
But of the songwriting, of the chord structures, that they key jump all the time, that it's all whimsical, but and yet it still has depth. It's not like the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band or something. This is comic and wry and has a kind of tongue-in-cheek quality that sometimes Steely Dan has in its lyrics, you know.
I think a lot of this, Gary, is that they were probably about the first band who from day one had their own studio. I think that's got a lot to do with that.
That's right, so they could afford to mess around.
Yeah.
And they had these incredible songwriting teams. So you've got Kevin and Lowell. Kevin's voice is amazing, right? So you've got Kevin and Lowell writing their very arty sort of things, you know, maybe one day they're in Paris or, you know, whatever they're singing about, or, you know, crazy songs about an AI computer talking to a 747 that's about a bomb that's about to blow up on a 747. I mean, you know, bizarre stuff like that. The audience are correcting me as I speak, I'm sure. And then they also, you know, had Graham and Eric writing together, you know, an extraordinary...
Who are the more sort of grown-up kind of Tin Pan Alley proper songwriters.
Well,
they,
yeah, really? I'm not in love, right? You know. But art for art's sake, man.
That's fine. I'm very sorry for you, Gary.
No, that wasn't a statement. So what about The Who?
The Who were fantastic. Also, well, The Who had Squeeze opening for them, which is always fantastic. Because they seem to be having such fun. And it's just, that is like, oh my God, what a catalogue. They didn't have the screen on behind them, which I thought was a bit mean for a charity gig. But The Who, of course, were fantastic. You know, we always love The Who. I've got to say, Roger was on better form than I've seen him for years. And it's possibly the only time I've ever seen The Who where he didn't make any sort of excuse for his voice. There was never, oh, sorry, I got a bit of a frog or a bit of a cold or anything, nothing. And he
wouldn't have a frog,
everything.
Roger, would he? He's Brexit, isn't he? He's
not gonna... That's very Brexit, yeah. but they've settled into this thing now. There's actually, because it's quite lighthearted, of it's almost like Morecambe and Wise, of like Pete's the grumpy old man, isn't it? I don't know what's going on. I haven't seen this set list before. Yeah, yeah. I didn't know we were going to be playing.
Yeah. And then during the show, shouting at his sound tech because he can't hear.
Usually because he didn't do sound check. but there was a very funny thing where at the start, before one song, it was Eminence Front, I think, he went to, I've got some bad news for you. Roger plays guitar on this one. And I spoke to Zach afterwards, to Zach Starkey, and I said, that's a bit much. He said, Roger can't hear him. They all just have their own in-ears. They can say what they want about each other.
Isn't it amazing? We talk about that 10cc song, and there's an 80-year-old Roger Daltrey still doing it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
actually feeling more confident, funnily enough.
Yeah, no, definitely. Definitely more confident than so the last time I saw them. Gary, I assume the 10cc gig, was that part of the Teenage Cancer Trust week?
I don't think it was, no. I think that's finished now.
Oh.
Yeah, no, I think that was just a regular gig where they were making money.
Right. Because this is a thing I think is worth bringing up, which is an absolute hats off to Roger Daltrey for this, which is the Teenage Cancer Trust gigs, which that week has become an absolute highlight of the music calendar.
Yeah.
And it's been 24 years he's done it. I think he's just standing down now.
It's amazing. And I mean, obviously it's quite a team, you know, along with the with Noel and Paul and all the other people have done it. And of course, recently our guest from a week or so ago, or Mark Knopfler, you know, bringing out that record.
We hadn't heard
we spoke to Mark, had we? I have to say, I did get in touch with you. I thought it was incredible, that record.
It was amazing. No, you said it was so moving. What I really liked, obviously, on a sort of personal bent for me, was because there's so many guitarists and it's a matter of who can you spot and who can't you? And it's like, there's a couple, you know, Hank, and as soon as David comes in, there he is.
Yeah, but it's really great at the beginning. You do know that's obviously Jeff at the front. There's Eric.
Of course.
There's David. And then Hank is beautiful, Woody. You're right. Yeah. And then they save all the sort of really loud boys to the end, don't they? And Pete's playing rhythm, apparently, so he doesn't get to do any sort of lead tricks and stuff.
No, it's power chords.
And you also saw Robert Plant.
Oh, mate, I did. I went to the White Rock Theatre in Hastings and saw Robert Plant and Saving Grace, who are, I've got to say, just amazing. And the band are fantastic. What he does is fantastic. And whoever's doing their front of house is incredible, because the way all the instruments and the voices are treated is fantastic and spot on. And there's the lovely Susie Dean singing. And he does amazing arrangements of a couple of Zeppelin songs. But then, you know, because he's an incredible musicologist and historian he knows so much about rock and roll,
Americana,
blues, country, Americana generally. In fact, I don't know if it's still there, but there's a cafe in Primrose Hill, which Andrew O'Hagan, the writer, set up.
Yeah. Sam's, that was called.
Sam's, that's right. And he and Robert Plant curated the jukebox.
Did he?
In it. And it's, and it's amazing because it was all songs, 50s clap, but versions you'd never heard of.
How clever. So
Dee doing monitors, who did the monitors for the Saucers for years. So that was lovely.
I like Dee, but he's a Spurs supporter, so that's where we differ. Right, but
it was going so well.
It was going so well. I also want to mention that the fact that Danny Baker is auctioning his 8,000 vinyl LPs, and I was just wondering, I mean, I couldn't do it I couldn't sell my LPs right now, because to me, those pieces of vinyl, they're my touchstone to my youth, you know, especially, you know, the ones that I bought at the time, or, you know, if I've tried to rebuy because I sold them when punk came out stupidly, you know, I try and buy those early pressings. They're the only thing I think I have in my house that directly connects me with being a kid who loves music. How do you feel?
No, I agree with that totally. Although, because I've been doing a funny thing, because now I'm in this house, which I know is my last house. So I've been trying to
How long have you got to live? Will?
Well, I'm trying to do this thing called Swedish death cleaning, which is that thing of basically going through your stuff and just realising, you know, all this, you hang on to it, but then your kids are just going to throw it in a skip, mate.
They are. I remember sadly pulling out the drawers and just pouring it into a black bin liner when my mum and dad died. I mean, it was
God knows what you missed in there. That's the thing, you know. Yeah.
Key to the Universe. But
it's funny. So I've been going through all my old sort of videos and DATs and stuff like that, and getting, because now you just get everything digitized, and then you throw everything away. But vinyl, that's not the same thing, because obviously music is available anywhere. So I know what you mean. It's that thing of the object. But unfortunately, Gary, your relationship with that object is your relationship with it and no one else's.
Well, that's good though, isn't it? I mean, I see what you mean.
No, it's good for you. But yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, because you remember there was a Bill Drummond, right? Who always has such great mad ideas. When Roger Eagle, the legendary East Liverpool character who's come up a few times on the podcast, apparently, because when he died, there was a thing of he had this legendary record collection. Because, you know, it's like Guy Stevens. Everyone used to go to see to him and he knew everything about
whose name's going to come up in this next interview. Anyway.
There you go. Yeah. And it was this thing of what should be done with Roger Eagle's record collection. And Bill Drummond said it needs to be encased in concrete so that it can never be touched or moved or seen or anything. But it's there. And it's fixed.
I see. Yes. And did that happen? No, I don't think that happened, did it? No. What would you save? I know it sounds like I'm on Desert Island Disc, but what would the one record be that you couldn't sell? If you had to keep one album, for me, it would be, because I mean, I know what mine is because I asked the question, right? But it would probably be Electric Warrior.
Is it Ziggy? Is it your
first
Ziggy?
It would be Electric Warrior. Yeah, because that was the one that set me on the journey. I remember getting T-Rex's Electric Warrior at Christmas when in 1971 maybe, and it was the first album I ever owned, and I still get that out occasionally and play it, and it brings back it puts me back in that moment of thinking how fantastic music was and how much it belonged to me.
Yeah, because my first ones, I get it, but my first ones are actually cassettes. Because I was at school, so it's like, and I don't know where it is. So yeah, the one, if I could find it, it would be my Who's Next cassette.
Ah, yes. You see, you've already started me now. I'm thinking of saving the Who's Next now.
There you go.
But
also, you made me think of something there, Gary. What? It's true because everyone did it. That thing of if you were smart, you would have gone around all the secondhand record shops in like 1978, 79, just buying all the prog albums because they would have been cheap as chips because we were all selling them.
Yeah, exactly. we before we get Robin on, we should just mention Steve Harley, who died, you know, a couple of weeks ago now. And, you know, how important he was as an artist. I just to briefly say, you know, that, you know, I mean, you know, Cockney Rebel came along at the same time as I think that sort of set, you know, Roxy and Bowie, obviously, and glam and the sense of the exotic that was entering music. And he certainly had the voice to express the exotic, didn't he? And did you ever meet him, Guy?
So I did, yes. In the early 80s. Yeah, he was a friend of Robin the Measurer. And he was very, very nice, but very passionate about music and everything, wasn't he? Clearly, and he always had that, didn't he? Also, one thing I think is really nice is to be remembered for is probably one of the greatest silences ever on a record.
Yeah. And they actually, that's a great trick because obviously you can stop a track and then count the bars and come back in, count the beats and come in. But he said, forget that. Just stick a bit of clean tape right into the middle of that verse and this next, that chorus and this next verse. And that's, I think that's what they did, didn't they? I mean,
yeah. So the time was just determined by however long a bit of tape he snipped.
Who was the guy who did the silent track? The art keyboardist.
Oh, no, was it Kale? It was Kale or Cage.
Cage, wasn't it?
Four minutes 55.
Yeah. Do you think they got him in to record the silence?
I think they might have used... So in fact, wasn't there a massive...
He does session silences.
Was there a massive copyright battle? Because they actually used...
he said
the tape
the
they
silence.
Used was actually from the second minute of his 4 minutes 55.
Right. Listen, we're going to get Robin Trower on now. I mean, you know, that Bridge of Sighs was a massive album. That's in my collection somewhere downstairs as we speak.
Do you know what? His Robin Trower Live was like one... That's actually what... I haven't got it, but that's one of the first albums I ever bought.
Yeah, there you are. Wow. So it'd be great to see him. He's just about to release a massive 50th anniversary box set. So I'm sure we'll be talking about that and a bit of Procol Harum.
Let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
OK, Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
That caused a big problem in the band, actually. I was having too much fun.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it, and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
To get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock Haunters podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Robin.
Hi there.
Hi, Robin.
I'm Gary Kemp.
Hi.
Hi, Robin. It's Sky. I don't know if you remember, but we worked together about 30 years ago.
Oh, it's not that long, is it?
I think it is, yeah, with Brian.
Oh,
with Brian Ferry.
I do remember.
Ah, good.
Very happy times.
Oh, that's nice to hear someone say about working with Brian.
Yeah.
What did you do together? What was it you were working on?
Robin was actually producing.
Well, I was sort of helping Brian produce.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was the album that ended up being Mamuna, wasn't it?
Mamuna, that's right, yeah. Hey. But yeah. You're on a few. I think we're on three Brian albums together. So
we've quite
the history, you and me, mate.
Yeah. I remember the excellent bass playing from your part.
Oh, dear man, thank you so much.
We've never
hear
met
that,
Robin.
Hear that?
I know. We've never met Robin, unfortunately. How did you end up producing Brian? How did you end up with that relationship?
Well, co-producer would be more correct. But I came in to do a session, guitar session, very early on in those sessions for that ended up being Mamuna. And asked me to come back and then come back again and, you know, sort of it developed.
He's great with guitarists, isn't he? Because, I mean, he's obviously worked with David. Johnny Marr he did stuff with as well, didn't he? So
what's his name? Johnny Greenwood?
Johnny Green, that's right. Well, Mick Green, it was actually a very funny thing that Johnny Marr said to us when we had him on, Robin. He said, a lot of people collect guitars. Brian collects guitarists.
Yeah, I think he's a guitar fan.
Yeah, definitely. He is, totally, yeah.
Robin, we should start off really by talking about the re-release of Bridge of Sighs, yes. You know, because that's obviously the exciting thing that's coming out now, this massive box set. I mean, it's huge. What do you want to just tell us what's in it?
Well, this Atmos remix, which I don't really understand what it is, but it does sound really good.
Who did it? Stephen, was it Stephen Wilson who's done it?
You got me there.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I was very impressed with it, I have to say. And the thing about it is I hadn't heard the album probably for 20 years, maybe longer. And it quite surprised me how well it stood up today. You know, and it's also got a live show from the 70s as part of the package, which was recorded in the record plant in LA for a radio station show, actually.
What year
and
was that?
I think it's 75, maybe. Yeah.
About the time you put out your live album, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, that's right. That's yeah.
But didn't you go back and find all the original tapes and you've all the sort of outtakes?
They did. Chris has did that. I must admit, I wasn't very hands-on.
But did you get to hear a lot of that old stuff that you hadn't heard for years? I mean, did...
Yeah, I had to check everything, you know, to make sure I passed it, that I thought it was, you know, up to the standard.
What do you think it is then about that album that makes it such a sort of monolith, you know, because it's such a huge statement?
Well, I think maybe I was in a purple patch writing-wise at the time, but I think what had a big bearing on its success was the fact that we played a lot of the songs, well, a few of the songs, live before we went in the studio. So we were already performing like Bridge of Sighs on tour. And I think the confidence is a big factor, you know, the sort of assurity of the performances. I think it's a big factor on that album.
you had a great band. I mean, it was a fantastic band. Bill Dewar seems to be, there's very much a reappraisal going on, isn't there? It seems like people feel James, he was very underrated.
James Dewar?
James Dewar.
James Dewar, yeah.
That's what I said.
One of the greats, without a doubt, in my opinion.
Singing bass players. I mean, that's, you know, rarest beast in the jungle.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, his voice was a magical instrument. There's no doubt about it. And I think his vocals are a very, very big part of why that was a commercial success, that album.
Yeah, I sent Guy a clip from YouTube last night to look at, which is you guys, I think in about 74, playing in San Francisco.
At Winterland.
At the Winterland. And I sent it to him because we often have this discussion how it's tricky for bass players to play and sing. And boy, does he play and sing, right? Because he's playing some of the most complex bass lines I've ever seen. I think it's on Lady Love.
Yeah.
And he's singing beautifully.
Mm. Yeah. He had a voice, there's no doubt about it. Very, very special guy. Very special.
And because you got him from Stone the Crows, didn't you?
Well, actually, I was, before I had my three piece with Jimmy and Reg, I was trying to form a band with Frankie Miller. And
I'm so glad you brought that up. I wanted to.
Yeah, Frankie was
that
another.
That seems
like
great, a great lost project.
Yeah, Frankie. Yeah, definitely. What a great singer. Mm. And he brought in Jimmy. So I didn't know Jimmy before that. But while we were sort of trying to knock it into shape, I sort of discovered that Jimmy had a wonderful voice. And so Jimmy was obviously the obvious choice, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I knew him, liked him as a guy, and he was great.
So was he not pushing himself as a singer? Was he happy to be a bass player then at that time?
Well, he came in as a bass player doing maybe a bit of background vocals in that. You know, but it didn't work out with me and Frankie. But as I say, it did lead to me having a really, really good lineup there in the three piece.
Because what his voice has, it does. It's not just like, you know, it's not that rock voice that you hear with Gillan or Plant or something like that. It has actually got soul. It's almost got, like, you know, it's almost Teddy Pendergrass at times. You know, it's one of those.
I think he was into singers, you know, like Bobby Blue Bland, and he liked Brooke Benton. So, you know, there's a bit of that in his influence, definitely. But, you know, the main thing is he had a beautiful instrument.
Well, but you probably picked up on that, Robin, because like you've always said that actually James Brown is your greatest influence, right? Which people might not necessarily.
Definitely. James Brown, I mean, especially James Brown Live at the Apollo, the first one. It's such a game-changing album, you know, and his vocals on that are the epitome of soul.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Did you ever see him?
But I did. I saw him in 1965. I think it was Walthamstow. And
James Brown and Walthamstow, they just go together, don't they?
Yeah, I know. I think it was like the Odeon.
That's the live album that should have happened.
Yeah. No Sleep Till Walthamstow.
I mean, he was totally jaw-droppingly good. And obviously the band was on another level to anything we'd ever heard. The amazing thing about it is that I always remember, he came on stage and didn't open his eyes for the first three songs. He was so obviously stoned. it was unbelievable. Yeah. And had a huge influence.
Let's just talk about you making that album, because the other great instrument, we're talking about James Dewar, but the real instrument is your guitar.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the thing is about, I remember, I hate to say this, but I was a kid. I was a 14-year-old, and I remember it, and I remember this great big stalking sound. I said the word monolith earlier. It was monolithic. It was, and I think it's the weird univibe thing that you have going on in there, and the distortion. But that riff didn't seem to come from anything American or English that I'd ever heard before. It felt, I mean, listen, I think it preceded Kashmir, but I might be wrong, but it had an Eastern feel to it. I mean, do you remember coming up with that?
I remember writing the whole piece musically, and I think it came together very quickly. I originally on an acoustic guitar, I think I wrote it, but it took about After I'd written the music, I think it took about 6 months to come up with the lyric. In fact, we were playing that song live, and we only had one verse, so Jimmy had to sing the same thing twice. But
Never bothered Oasis.
There you go.
but Jeff Emmerich was the guy helping to get the sound, wasn't he?
Jeff has got to take full credit for the way that sounds, you know, because I think he came up with a completely different way of recording loud guitar. He did it by putting three mics in steps down the room. So, you know, he got sort of one that was 3 foot and then 6 foot and then 9 foot, you know, that kind of spacing. And I think that's what made it so big sounding, because you were getting so much of the room as well. And it was a very good sounding room. That was at Air London.
Ah, well, the old upstairs one, yeah. Actually, little technical point, that's the same mic technique that Visconti used for Bowie's vocal on Heroes.
There you go.
Well, didn't Visconti work with you at one point?
I think Procol Harum.
Yeah.
Procol Harum, did he produce an album?
He produced one of your albums. I can't remember which one it was. Right, maybe Broken Barricades.
All right. Okay. Yeah. I'm so old, I can't remember
that's
now.
All right. It's all right. We just like to join the dots in this show, you know. But let's go back to that, because obviously Jeff Emmerich's involved, because it's Air, I'm guessing. And Air is George Martin's studio, isn't it?
Yeah.
So did he just come with it? You didn't have to... that's the thing, wasn't it, in the 70s? The engineer was whoever was in the studio, right?
Yeah,
you had the house guy.
I think we just fell on our feet there.
I say, lucky. That was Andy, wasn't it?
Yeah, dead lucky.
So much
in terms of his, you know, ability.
And I guess it's inspiring to be in the same room as the guy who engineered Sgt. Pepper's, isn't it, really?
Absolutely.
But you had Matthew Fisher producing, who was, so just to fill people in, Matthew Fisher was the organist in Procol Harum, and obviously the one that ended up in court with Gary Brooker at some stage much later on when they were trying to decide who wrote that song. We won't go there.
Why not, Gary?
but obviously, because obviously your loyalty is with Matthew as well, because he's still around and he produced the album. I mean, how did you? Because I suppose what we have to do really is go back to the beginning and see how all of you people met somewhere in Essex, I guess.
South End
was it? Was that not Essex?
Yeah. Well, Gary and I had a band before Procol Harum. We had a band called Paramount.
Which is can I just say what a great name that is?
Yeah,
it really is.
So beat group,
and you know, we were doing James Brown and Bobby Bland and all that kind of stuff, and but eventually I think I left because I got sort of bored with.
Were you on the track? Did you do Poison Ivy with the band?
That's right. Yeah, Poison Ivy, and
we
did some three or four recordings, but. Nothing clicked.
But where had you come together? Were we after school, or was it at school, or you know?
No, I think it was after school. So we were like 17, 18, I think, when Gary and I got together. I saw him playing with a friend of mine who was also a guitar player, and I wanted to have put together a band that was really an imitation of another band that came from Romford called the Rockefellers, and they were dynamite. And they were my heroes. So that's why I got together with Gary, sort of thinking...
Whatever happened to any of the Rockefellers?
Well...
They became the Gettys. They wrote Getty Back.
They were dynamite, but I think because they weren't writers, they didn't write any songs or anything. Right. You know, they were just doing covers. But they were fabulous. In fact, they were called the Fabulous Rockefellers. And anyway, so Gary and I got together, and I also had a mate that I was sort of playing guitars with, Chris Copping. He came in on bass, and we got a guy called Mick Brownlee on drums, and that's how that band started.
But how did you just to fill us in? When did you decide you wanted to be a guitarist, and who was the influence?
Well, my biggest influence is Scotty Moore with Elvis. Yeah. You know, the guitar playing on early Elvis's tracks, absolutely wonderful. And it's because of him I wanted to play guitar, so I got my dad to buy me a guitar. So he is my biggest influence.
You're one of the first to say that, because most people on the show end up saying Hank, don't they? But I think Scotty Moore doesn't get the credit he deserves, you know.
No, definitely not. I mean, I often think, you know, if it hadn't been for his guitar playing, I wonder if Elvis would have made the impact with his early stuff. Mm. You know, because the guitar was so unique and just musical, but dynamic.
Also, that incredible push-pull between the guitar and the bass. There was always someone in four and someone in three. That was, you know.
Yeah, yeah. He was very special, Scotty Moore, definitely. And, you know, I've got obviously lots of other influences. B.B. King, Albert King, Jimi Hendrix, you know. Those three, in fact, I think of as my mentors.
So blues was happening, wasn't it, for everybody? You were part of that blues boom that you know, the Stones would have been part of.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, by the time I joined Procol Harum, I was sort of studying Howling Wolf and Muddy Waters, you know, and James Brown Live at the Apollo as well. You know, it was that was my that was what I was boning up on.
So it already seems like a bit of a discrepancy, really, because it sounds like, because you know, it's not quite the music that Procol Harum was going to make.
No, that's right. But I think I'm musical enough to blend into what they were doing.
Yeah, because I mean, it couldn't be, especially back then, there couldn't have been a more keyboardy band, you know, when you listen to it. Well, yeah, what's interesting, it was going back and listening to those albums for this, actually, was one spotted before was definitely massive influence on Genesis, early Genesis.
Oh, completely. I mean, A Salty Dog is very pre-Genesis, isn't it?
Yeah, I think they were very influential. Yeah. Very cool. I think, you know, it was a unique thing when it came along. Gary's writing was very unique, and obviously Matthew was like a brilliant musician on organ. So, you know, there was...
Well, it was one of the first bands, probably, you know, if we're looking at the history of prog, it was one of the first bands to make that classical music, rock music combination, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think the one saving grace for Procol is the fact that Gary came from a real rock and roll R&B background. Right. So I think there was, you know, a bit more soul in it.
Yeah, his voice is great.
That's true. Also, probably the first truly prog name for a band.
Yeah. It was named after a cat.
It was a cat. It? Oh, yeah, and then but spelt wrong because it was taken down over the phone.
Is that true, Robin?
I think that is true. Yeah, but you guys have been boning up, haven't you?
We have. Do you know what? I'm just going to mention, because there is a little bit of an animal theme going on here, isn't there? Right. So the band Procol Harum gets named after a blue Burmese cat who's owned by some girlfriend of the band. Salty Dog, right? So you've already got cat and dog. And and apparently, I'm going to... You know what the last one is? The last one is a horse guy. Why is it a horse?
What?
Bridge of Sighs was named after a horse. Is that right, Robin?
Yeah. That is a story. I had the song, and one day I picked up a newspaper and looking through, and it said on the back sports pages, Bridge of Sighs to win. So I thought, what a great title that would be. And there you go.
You could have said the famous Prisoner's Bridge in Venice, but good on you for going with the horse.
Thank God.
Being truthful.
Yeah, thank God for the sporting life.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You came into the band after White A Shade of Pale. Did that feel like you were having to play catch up? a bit, or that you already had this big kind of big other song around your neck that you couldn't get away from?
I think when I first joined them, I thought to myself, how jammy is that? Joining a band, that's number one.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is that.
Yeah. And we went more or less straight into the studio to do the album. And
that's,
I think,
with Denny Cordell, right?
That's right. Fantastic. Yeah. And I think we just got so engrossed in that. I think everything else was very much in the background.
Yeah. I should mention Keith Reid, because there was a similarity. I mean, one of the things that I can hear in Procol is King Crimson ended up grasping as well. And I know there's a connection between you and Fripp, but also there's this other connection where, as Pete Sinfield was in the band just to write the lyrics in King Crimson, you've got Keith Reid in your band, Procol, just writing the lyrics, right?
Yeah. Well, in actual fact, I think it's Keith and Gary that actually formed the band. So I think I'm right in saying that somebody from Island Records,
Guy Stevens.
Yeah, that's it.
Oh, Guy Stevens. Oh.
Recommended Keith to Gary. So
that's what it was meant to be. That, they just wanted to write, didn't they? There wasn't meant to be a band.
Classic music lyricist, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And they just started putting some songs together. And
no one wanted them. So they, I think,
I don't know. Is that right?
I read that somewhere that's why that it was, so it was sort of, you know, the old necessity is the mother of invention. That's why they started a band.
Yeah.
But what about your relationship with Fripp? Because he says some nice stuff about you. And I did read somewhere on the internet that he took lessons from you. Is that true?
Yeah. He shines that up a little bit. I mean, we got together when we were touring in the States. We were opening up. I think we were supporting 10 years after, if I remember rightly. We became, you know, good friends. And it's just one day Bob asked me to show him a couple of things that I do, you know, what he would call blues licks. And, you know, I tried, but anyway, yeah, he always said, oh, I gave him lessons. That's not quite true. He's so sweet and kind about that.
I think he might have been turned on by your sustained sound, which was at that time quite a unique kind of approach to the guitar.
Yeah, it's just a matter of playing too bloody loud, which is why I'm half deaf now.
Yeah, because you did always, you had a pretty big rig on stage from early on, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, I used to use 200 or 300 watt stacks. But
there's three of you. You're a power trio. I mean, you've got to fill the stage, right? I mean,
and these were big places as well. That was the thing, big hockey arenas and all that kind of thing in the States, you know. So, and monitor systems weren't what they are today, you know. In fact, they're practically non-existent in that.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, before 1970, wasn't it? It was pretty much no, until Charlie Watkins came up with it. There wasn't really any monitoring.
Yeah, well, I mean, they had some good PAs in the 70s when we were starting to tour the big places. But as I say, monitor systems, people didn't really think about that so much.
Some story about Jimi Hendrix getting on stage with Procol Harum and playing bass. Were you there at that?
No, that was before I joined.
But obviously, Jimmy was a big influence on you. Do you remember that first time you saw him, or did you ever meet him?
I did briefly, very very briefly. We did a show in Berlin, Procol, I'm talking about, and Jimi Hendrix was top of the bill, and I got to say hello, and obviously I stood on the side of the stage during his set, watching his set, and. For about a year after that, I was considering giving up playing the guitar.
You and Eric, because Eric thought the same thing, didn't he, when he first saw him at the Bag of Nails or wherever it was.
They wanted him killed, didn't he? Wasn't it was that story that all the guitarists got together to hire a hitman?
Yeah. No, he was that good. He was that good. He was too good.
Okay, so let's talk about the festivals, because the story is that you didn't do Woodstock because you personally had something else you had to do. Is that right, Robin?
That's right. We didn't do Woodstock, yeah.
But you did do the 1970...
But hang on, what else did you have to do? Your laundry?
My wife was expecting.
Oh. Oh,
well. I couldn't be away. It's right at that moment, so...
No regrets.
No, not really.
I would have done the same thing. You didn't even know what Woodstock was going to be. No one knew how big Woodstock was in legend.
It sounded like it was going to be chaos.
Absolutely. And it was chaos. In the movie, it looks okay.
And did the rest of the band never ever sort of got like, we could have been there. We should have been there.
I'm sure they did.
Yeah. But because you did play the Isle of Wight Festival in 1970, which, I mean, when you read the numbers at that guy, 700,000 people in the crowd. Have they ever got? Could you imagine that invasion on that nice little polite island that's never seen anything like it before?
Well, just the weight. Island, exactly.
The Isle of Wight. How was that? Because, of course, Jimmy was there as well, obviously.
Yeah, well, I enjoyed it. I thought it was great, excellent. We had a good time there. But we left the island straight after playing because I think, you had to make way for other people and dressing rooms and all that sort of thing. So I didn't get to see Jimi Hendrix that time.
Oh, but The Who were on as well. So I remember apparently the Who had to give them part of their PA. There was some story about that, but also Rory Gallagher. And I just wanted to talk about that, because was there a sort of sense of a great competition between, because there was obviously Rory was rising and there was so many, it was the era of the great guitar player. And how did you feel? Did you have the confidence to feel that you were as good as any one of those, or was there, how was that experience?
Well, I think maybe I came along a little later. Where, there was a few in the late 60s were making their name. And I didn't really come along until 73.
Yeah.
I can't say I ever really thought about it as being competitive.
Was it because did you feel that it got to the point with Procol Harum where there just wasn't, you just had too much guitar to play and there just wasn't room for it,
Well, I think the thing was I was starting to write a lot of guitar music for songs. And there just wasn't space in that band. And I knew I wanted to have a three piece and just where the guitar was the main thing, because that's where the writing was going. So, I had to quit and give it a go.
Because you didn't seem to have that sound in Procol, did you? It was something you sort of brought to the table afterwards. Was there a seminal moment when you went, shit, this is it. This is the sound I need.
I'm not sure.
Could you just turn up because the organ wasn't there anymore?
I think that's the beauty of a three piece, is that, and I think why I love doing it is because it's a challenge to make up for the instrument that's missing. Yeah. And so you've got to make a big noise, and that makes it all the more exciting. So I think that's why I got into it. Yeah.
And the Univibe, I think, has probably got part of, because I've having worked with David for years, who's a massive Univibe proponent, but that's right. that just makes the guitar fill out so much space as well, doesn't it?
That's right. It's sort of like a Leslie-ish sweeping
psychedelic
vibrato. It makes it otherworldly. There's no doubt about it, and especially when you crank it through, a couple of Marshalls. And I actually stumbled across the Univibe. I was sort of trying out stuff in at Manny's in New York, and they brought this in, and I thought, "Oh, what's that? That's interesting." I started to use it in Procol on Song for a Dreamer. I used it, and a couple of other things on Broken Barricades. So that was the beginning of me wanting to write more guitar stuff, really.
Mm. And do you still have that Univibe? Do you still use it on stage, or do you have other digital?
I use
versions?
A thing called a Deja Vibe, which is a much more reliable, less background noise. I mean,
the boutique version.
Yeah. And all my pedals are made by a Full Tone in California. So that sort of brought it up to date. It's not exactly the same as the Deja Vibe, but it definitely does a good job.
There's a sense with Procol, and I'm not, maybe even with yourself, Robin, that you were bigger in America than you were in your own country. Mm-hmm. And I know from talking to Joe Elliott from Def Leppard, they were much bigger in America than they were in their own country. That as much as it was fantastic for the bank, and that's where music was from, and FM radio was happening, there was still an element of frustration that there was the lack of respect when you got back home. Did you sense that with the band?
That's a good one. Actually, I'm not sure it ever bothered us. I can't think. America, you know, the whole of the US really is so huge. You're playing in all lots of different countries, really. And I think that's satisfying enough in terms of if you want success, if you've got success there, I think it's satisfying enough.
Yeah, because if you're successful in the UK and not successful in America, you feel like you've not done it, right?
I was going to say, there's plenty of bands who would look very jealously at American success. I always thought, actually, that European success is underrated because Europe as a whole is basically the same as the States.
Yeah.
And it's very nice, very nice for touring. A lot more, better food.
Yeah, I love touring in Europe, especially Germany. I mean, wonderful.
And you were, as a solo artist, you were very big in Europe, weren't you, Robin? Were you not?
We did well in Europe, I think we did, yeah.
Just want to mention Reg Isidor, because what a drummer. Yeah. Unusual to have a black guy in rock and roll, as it were, in those days as well, right?
He was unique, Reg. He had such a lovely feeling to what he did. You know, you could listen to him sitting there just playing a beat, and there was something magical about it. You know, I just think he had a great gift. You know, maybe he wasn't technically sort of up with the top guys. I have to say his drumming was soulful.
It was very soulful, but he also had this lovely jazzy thing that he tended to play the ride more than the hi-hat, which just gives you this lovely swing. Everything. Also, because he worked, of course, he played on Wet Dream, Rick Wright's first solo album.
Right.
Which, in fact, I've just been involved in getting remixed by Stephen Wilson. And his work on that is beautiful. So,
he's a soulful drummer.
Yeah, there's a great clip on YouTube of you guys on Old Grey Whistle Test. That very trio. I think you're doing Bridge of Sighs, maybe, or something like that. But it's a fantastic, you know, opportunity to see the band, how they sounded live. But you were saying that Reggie's brother is...
His little brother's Gus. Gus Isidor, who was kind of a great guitarist and Seal's sort of right-hand man.
Yeah.
Yeah, another very talented Isidor.
Yeah, yeah. And then, Gary, you were talking about Isadora Duncan.
That's my own fantasy. I, you know what I wanted to tell you is that I saw the original artwork for Bridge of Sighs in Chris Wright's house. Chris Wright owns Chrysalis Records, and my old band was signed to Chrysalis, and I know you were signed to Chrysalis. And I remember, because obviously I had the album, but I remember going to Chris's house for some end of year drink in the 80s and seeing it on the wall. It was in a frame, I remember, but it's actually three dimensional, isn't it? It's a piece of, it's clay painted, and it's by this, it's amazing guy, the Funky Paul Olsen. Do you want to tell us about how you met Funky Paul and how it all came about? It's such a classic album sleeve.
I met Funky Paul in San Francisco in Procol Harum when we were doing the Fillmore. And I think Paul and his friend were both doing posters, I think maybe for the Avalon, not for the Fillmore. But anyway, we met them and... I think, you know, because I'd seen his poster work, I think when I bumped into him in London, about the time I was doing the first album.
Yeah, you're outside Olympia, I think, wasn't it?
That's right. You got it. Yeah, because he lived just around the corner to Olympia.
In Barnes.
Olympic. And
Olympic, sorry.
Yeah. I said to him, look, this was twice removed from yesterday. I said, this is the title. See what you can come up with. And that's how it started. Yeah.
Is he still around?
I haven't heard from him lately. I'm sure he is. Yeah. No, I haven't heard from him for a couple of years, but I'm sure he's still around. Yeah.
And so what is it comprised of, the artwork then? How's it done?
It's clay, and it's what's it's called Möbius, that little symbol, isn't it?
Mm, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I'm sure what's happened there is that Paul did a special version of it for Chris Wright. Because obviously Chrysalis owned the artwork because, you know, they would have bought it off of him.
So do you know...
But I think he may have done a special version of it.
Because I think it added to the music, and we're mentioning this because you've got your 50th anniversary package coming out, but I said earlier about that guitar riff on Bridge of Sighs sounding very Eastern. And actually, that I always thought that sleeve looked like sand dunes, didn't it? It looked like it was out in the
Sahara. Well, even the writing.
Even the writing, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. It's slightly Arabic-looking writing.
Yeah. So had he heard the track before he decided what the artwork would be?
Did he? Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure. Now, I mean, of course, it is a long time ago.
Yeah, I know. 50 years.
Say anything, Robin. We don't know.
I have to say, Robin, you look absolutely cool. You look like an old mod sitting there in your cap and your leather jacket.
He's a rocker. He's an old rocker.
And he is a rocker, really, isn't he? But he looks fantastic. And
thank you very much.
You're obviously in good health. Are you going out on the road?
Yeah, we've got some UK dates coming up at the end of May, and then the US in the autumn.
How big is the US tour?
Be 6 or 7 weeks.
And wow. So who's the band now?
I've got the guys that were on my last couple of albums. Mm. Well, the last album that we did as a band was No More Worlds to Conquer. And that's Richard Watts on bass and vocals and Chris Taggart on drums.
And you still never fancy getting a keyboard player in, do you, really? I mean, it's always going to be the power trio now.
Or two.
Two, yeah.
Well, the thing is, if you get somebody playing chords, it limits what I can do with the lead work in terms of melodies. Because if they're tying down chord changes, or even whether it's major or minor, you know, I think I like to play things that it's not stated whether it's major or minor.
Neutral.
Well, you know, so it's difficult. I can't imagine doing my stuff anyway, not with a keyboard.
And is there still improvisation in it as well?
Yeah, that's it. I like to have that freedom to wander about.
Well, thank you for coming on.
No, I was just going to say also the fact that you don't have another guitarist, which is great, which means you always have to have great faith in your bass player.
Yeah, that's true. That is very true. But of course, I have to make a lot of sound, which is, I think I was saying earlier, is the challenge, which I enjoy.
This is why I think the Atmos,
a lot of space,
the Atmos,
you know,
mix of this is going to sound amazing as well. Because to get that swirling guitar sound going all the way around you, because basically Atmos is a 360 sound thing, which still apparently has an effect even if you listen to it on headphones.
Yeah.
You don't have to have an 8.1 right. system. So good luck with the box set, Robin, and the tour.
Thank you very much.
No, it was great talking. Lovely to see you again, Robin. Thank you.
It's great to see you.
Ah. Oh.
Yeah.
Marvellous.
Happy days with Brian, eh?
Happy days with Brian. I saw him the other week, actually. Dear old Brian.
How's he doing?
He's all right, yeah. And I went in the studio with him. But he's pottering about.
Has he got a guitar player that he loves?
not this week.
I put my name in.
Yeah.
All right, Robin. Thanks a lot, mate.
Great. Thanks
Cheers.
A lot, guys.
Thanks, Robin. Cheers. All the best, mate.
Bye. Bye.
All the best.
Hey, very good. Did you like my animal reference?
That was very, very good. That's very good. Were you saving that up? Were you kind of hoping?
I've been up all night thinking about it. Yeah. But they were coming in two by two and I fell asleep.
Oh,
or with the sheep.
Stop counting sheep.
Sheep
exactly.
Jumping over the fence. Guy, you were nearly taken out during that. I saw the corner of my eye.
I was going to say, my level of professionalism here, I'm like that sort of proper hardcore war reporter, that I have this vocal booth I'm working in, which has this sort of metal struts that support it at the top. And one of them fell off, or the main one that goes all the way around it, fell off and clocked me right on the head. And I'm sure you can hear it on the recording.
Wow. I always thought you were in
a... In fact, Ben, can I have that as a sample? I'm going to use it as my new ringtone.
I always thought you were in a telephone booth putting 10p's in. So I think we're off for a couple of weeks. I think we're going to have a little Easter holiday.
A little Easter holiday, get some eggs in.
And then back with someone huge and big and awesome and a guest.
And scary.
And a guest as well.
And a guest. Brilliant. Yes, so it's good night from me. Thanks to Ben, ever.
Ben, our producer. And it's good night from me.
Rock Haunters is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.